Lecture 14, Dialects, Subspecies of Species.
This lecture is going to be about language versus dialect. And the reason that this is important is not only because of the sociological aspects of the dialect issue, but also because understanding what a dialect is crucial when we look at the natural history of languages all over the world. So not just English and the dialects of English that we talk about, but dialects all over the world. Because, in fact, there are dialects all over the world. Really, when you get right down to it, there's no such thing as a language. And, of course, I'm being kind of cute in putting it that way. But really, the notion that, say, French is a language is an artificial, arbitrary concept. And that's because most of what we call languages are really, if you look at them close up, bundles of dialects. That is, they're bundles of variations on a theme, and that's what dialects are. So it's kind of like if you look at a cell in an organism. Inside the cell are all these organelles and a nucleus. And then you look closer and you find out that all these things are made of molecules. And then a molecule is made of atoms. And then an atom is made out of protons, neutrons, and electrons. They are made out of something called quarks, and so on. I don't know the so on, but presumably there's a so on. In the same way, languages, when you look at them up close, are dialects. So, for example, if you are in Great Britain, you see a wide variety of Englishes, so to speak. So there's the standard English of Great Britain, which we're familiar with, but then there are all sorts of other Englishes. And so in the standard, there would be something like the government has today decreed that all British beef is safe for consumption. But then you'll have something like Scots. And in Scots, the way that they might say, after he had gone through all of it, a great famine broke out in the land, they might say, after he had gained through the hell of it, a fell famine broke out in your land. Now, that doesn't sound like another language, but it's no English that we are likely used to unless we are Scots. I am not. If you look at Lancashire dialect, the way to say, we've just now taken a horse stealer who was making off with it, is something like, we meet now ta'en a horse stealer that would man off with it. That's just ordinary English. That's an English dialect, just like standard English is an English dialect, as we will see. Lady Chatterley's lover, the gardener, who is so sexy, apparently, he is depicted with an accent unfamiliar to Americans, and it's not only an accent, but it's a different kind of grammar. He is speaking a Nottinghamshire variety of English. So at one point, he says, you must come one night to the cottage before you go, will you? And the way he puts it is, thou mun come one night to the cottage afore thou go, shelter. And that's English. And at one point, Lady Chatterley says, why can't you speak proper English? But actually what he's speaking is a variation upon English. And dialects get even further out, in a way. So we say in standard English, he isn't going to tell you. In Cornwall, a region of England, the way that would come out is, I bain't gwine for telly. So he isn't going to tell you, I bain't gwine for telly. That way of speaking is extinct now, but it's pretty well documented. Now, we can only understand what dialects like that are if we shed a certain misconception, and that is that a dialect is a degraded version of the standard language. It's easy to think that when people speak in these ways, which we can admit sound funny, they do to our ear, unless we grew up speaking that way, that those are somehow lesser versions than the standard. We might think that they're cute, we might think that they're exotic, but we also think that that's a departure from the way the language was or should be or is. Very understandable that we often think that way, but actually, what creates a dialect is not sloth. It's not slips of the tongue and certain berries that people eat in the woods or something like that. What it is just language change as we've seen it in previous lectures in this series. The same kind of language change that created English from what was an earlier Germanic ancestor, which was before that Proto-Indo-European, creates these dialects. So here's what I mean. Remember from a previous lecture how there was once Latin, and French and Spanish and Italian and Portuguese didn't exist. And then Latin disappeared as a living spoken language and developed into French, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, and Romanian. And so we talked about how in Latin, if you would say, I gave it to the woman, referring to a present or a book, then it would be Feminae I dedi. And then in French now, it's Je l'ai donné à la femme. In Spanish, it's Se lo di a la mujer, and so on, all of which are quite different from Feminae I dedi. Now, in this case, Latin became all of these different languages. And there's no question that Spanish is bad Latin. Spanish is Spanish. Latin was something else, and we respect them both. Dialects are the pathway from one language to a bunch of new languages, except in the middle of that pathway. So it's when the process has not gone all the way. It's the intermediate stage. So if you can imagine the development from Latin to French, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, and Romanian as a bush, with Latin being down on the ground and French, Spanish, and Italian, and Portuguese, and Romanian being leaves outside on top and on the sides of the bush that you might trim with hedges or something like that. The dialects are somewhere down in the middle of the bush. And so it's not the trunk, but it's not yet the tips of the branches. It's what happens when this change has only gone so far. So French and Spanish and Italian have diverged from Latin so much that they're completely different languages. Dialects are when that process has only gone halfway. So you don't have different languages. What you have is just variations on a theme. Those variations are the dialects. And so it's a very simple concept. That's how a dialect develops. Now, what's interesting is that often we look at dialects as something illegitimate, and the separate languages are okay, when in fact we have historical documentation of a time when the languages were not separate enough to be seen as new languages yet. They were still just dialects of something else, and people thought of them as the wrong thing. So, for example, there was a time when Latin had diverged into several different varieties. Linguists often call this early Romance. And it was one way in what's now France. It was one way in what's now Italy. But really, all of these things still seemed like the same language. They were different kinds of Latin. And as we might expect, people of that time who were educated often thought that these new kinds of Latin in these regions were bastardized speech, that these weren't the way language is actually supposed to be. So one of my favorite quotes along these lines is from 63 AD. So we're talking about almost 2,000 years ago, and Latin is diverging in places, but there's no such thing as Italian or Portuguese yet. It's just that Latin varies from place to place. So somebody is in what is today France, and they make this complaint in Latin. Spoken Latin has picked up a passel of words considered too casual for written Latin, and the grammar people use when speaking has broken down. The masses barely use anything but the nominative and the accusative. Why? It's gotten to the point that the student of Latin is writing in what is to them an artificial language, and it's an effort for him to recite in it decently. I stuck in that little rhetorical why because I can just tell that that's what he meant, but the rest of it is word for word. Now, that made perfect sense to him. What he heard as bad Latin is what we would hear as, well, French. It's just a matter of how time passes and also whether or not this new variety happens to become the way people talk as an official part of a new nation. Nationalism was connected with this. But this shows that a dialect is an intermediate stage along something where there is no point where we have any reason to think that something illegitimate has happened. So, for example, the French that this person heard in 63 AD presumably was not quite the French that we know now. But we can't really say that there's this intermediate point where it's neither fish nor fowl and it's wrong, because, of course, our lives only take place within about 80-year spans, and so language changes very slowly, and so the logic just doesn't quite work. You imagine the development of horses. Horses began as these little five-toed creatures that were the size of big rabbits, rabbits that would be big enough that, you know, they could probably serve a family, but big rabbits. And they were called Hyracotherium or Eohippus. They were little. They were the sort of thing that you could kick and it wouldn't be able to hurt you back. And then that gradually evolved into the massive, spitting, repulsive creatures that are horses now. I had a bad experience with a horse once. I was in a play, and I had to ride it, and it almost threw me. So I don't like horses. But there was the little one, and then there's the big one. Now, in between, there were these kind of medium-sized horses, the size of ponies today. But they weren't ponies because there were no horses bigger than that. One of them was called a Mesohippus. Now, if we were alive in the time when the biggest horses got was Mesohippus, it wouldn't make sense to say, you are an insufficient horse. You are horse light, because I know that in the future you're going to get bigger. And so this medium-sizedness of yours is illegitimate. Now, back in that time, that was fine. In the same way, dialects are fine. All fluently spoken human language is fine. In any case, we can go back to English. And so, if you look at English today, then you can take a sentence like, he's not going to tell you anything. Now, the proper way to think of it is that in Old English, the way the sentence would have gone was something like, he nulle the nacht ashegan. And so, he not will to you nothing to say. It was a very different language. Now, today, in standard, that's become, he's not going to tell you anything. In the honeymooners' Brooklyn, it might be, Norton, he ain't gonna tell you nothing. And that's different. And then in Northern British, and so if you watch some British TV shows, Catherine Zeta-Jones had her early work on one called The Darling Buds of May. You can hear this, or various other ones. Then it would come out something like, he's none going to tell you note. So nothing is note. And that's, you know, we have not, we don't use it, they still use it as not. In Cornwall, it would have been, a bank gwine for telly nothing. And so, he's not going to tell you anything. A bank gwine for telly nothing. It's English, it's just different. Scots, one variety of Scots would have it as, he winna tell thee anything. All of these are English. We don't hear these much in America. Even that Brooklyn dialect is eroding. But those are all ways that English has been spoken and still is. And standard English is just one of the gang. And here's an important point about that, which is that all of these dialects trace back not to standard English. It's not that at some point everybody was talking the way I'm talking now, then all of a sudden there were all these departures. The way I'm talking now was, along with all of these things, something that developed from, if you want an ancestor, it has to be Old English. And I don't think any of us mourn Old English. We're not wishing people still ran around talking that way. Old English is gone, and you can study it in books, and I imagine there are clubs where people walk around speaking it and clanking tankards of ale or something. Good for them. But it's gone. In the meantime, we have our English, but it only developed alongside. It's like one of many mewing kittens. So, important to realize that the standard came from Old English just like all the others, and most languages are bundles of dialects like that. So, for example, English borrowed the word warrant from French. But if you look at French as we're taught it today, then the word begins with G. It's garant. Well, what's that about? Well, it is about something, which is that we borrowed warrant not from standard French, or what would become standard French. We borrowed it from Norman French. Norman French is a different dialect than standard French, and often where standard French has a G, like in garant, this Norman French has a W, as in warrant, and so we have warrant. And that's because French comes in different dialects. Italian dialects are so different from each other that it's kind of a stretch to imagine that there's any one language Italian. So, for example, in The Godfather, when there is Italian spoken in the scenes that take place in Sicily, you can have been an A student in an Italian class, and you have no idea what those people are saying, because Sicilian is essentially a different language. And that doesn't only happen in the exotic South, where the Sopranos' ancestors come from. You go up north, and you get these things that look kind of like the result of chance matings between French and Italian deep in the night, but that nobody in Italy would be able to understand without either drugs or training. So Italian is a great many things. Talk to many Italian Americans who are descended from Southern Italians and listen to the way they spontaneously pronounce certain Italian things, because they've heard it pronounced that way by their relatives who were descended from people who actually were in Sicily. You look at a package and it says ricotta. ricotta cheese. And so if you're not Italian, you say ricotta. Listen to a real American Italian and they call it rigotte. And often they're not thinking about rigotte. No, and you say no, ricotta, rigotte. Well, that's because ricotta is standard Italian, which is one of many dialects, rigotte. That is the way they say it in Sicily, and it's based on the kind of sound changes we've seen. Ricotta. That ah is just ripe for falling away, because sounds tend to fall away at the end of words. And instead of ricotta, that sound's going to soften into a g. You can almost predict it. And so, as a matter of fact, manicotti in these people's mouths tends to come out as manigot. Same thing. You know that's what's going to happen to that word. The standard is one thing, but then there are these other dialects which are moving along. All of these are developed from the same original ancestor. They develop at different paces. Or Germany. Germany is a country, just like Italy, where as you move around, if you're dealing with the way people speak casually, you start wondering why there's any one thing called German. And it depends on what region you're in. But particularly when you get down to the south, you're dealing with a different tongue. I've gone to southern Germany and been at a complete linguistic loss, even though I was having a grand old time up in the north. And the people know it. You know, there's an extent to which a Bavarian knows that they are speaking a separate language. They might not put it that way, but it's quite different. I have had to tell the occasional Bavarian taxi driver, I'm sorry, but can you please, you know, speak, you know, high German, because this thing that you're doing, I'm not familiar. And so, for example, you have something in high German, du hast etwas. In Schwäbisch, down in the south, it's de hesch opus. So, du hast etwas de hesch opus. You can kind of see the relationship, but it's very, very different. So, dialects are everywhere. It's not just interesting things that happen to English because of the nature of England and or America. It's the way languages are. Nor is it just something interesting about America, England, and Italy. This is something that you can see in languages all over the world. And what this means is that the standard dialect is really just lucky. If you look at a bunch of black Labrador puppies in the window on 57th Street, in New York, right now, as we're taping this, there are a whole bunch of little puppies, and all of them are really cute. There's one of them that I like because there's something a little funny about one of its eyes. And if I had the patience to have a dog, I would go in there and I would take that one. And there's nothing better about that one. It's just the one that kind of reminds me of myself somehow. That's the lucky one in the window. The siblings of that little puppy are the non-standard dialects. And so, when a language is a written one, and this is actually not most of the world's languages, but if we're talking about a written language, one of its dialects, because if it's a language, then it is going to actually be a bundle of dialects, a bundle of Labrador puppies squirming around, licking each other. One of them gets chosen as the standard dialect to live with me in my apartment. And that dialect is used in writing, it's used in public contexts, and that dialect developed along with the other ones, but it happened to get chosen. It's been said that a standard is a dialect with an army and a navy. If you take a class on this, you're always going to get that delicious phrase. And it's true. Generally, the one that's chosen is chosen because it has the juice in some kind of way. So there was a standard French that happened to be spoken because the national courts settled in that Île-de-France region. It's not that there was anything about that variety, but that is what we now know as the elegant language of love, French. Castilian Spanish was and is one of a bunch that was chosen because it happened to be the variety of Spanish spoken by the armies who went south and helped to get rid of the Moors. So they had a certain juice in society. Their way of speaking became the model. Italian's standard is the Tuscan variety, and that happens to be the area that produced Dante and Boccaccio. So there was a prestige there. So that becomes the quote-unquote real Italian. But if things had been otherwise, Sicilian with the rigotte and the manigotte would have been real, and the Tuscan variety would have been considered the odd one that never gets written down. It's a matter of geopolitics. So standard English is the English that happened to be spoken in the region where London was. And London was a center of power, and there were large universities near it. Before this, English was a patchwork of very different dialects. There's a story that William Caxton, the pioneer printer, tells in the late 1400s of a Londoner who had gone eastward to the region of Kent. And in Kent, there was what we now call Kentish spoken. Kentish was so different that when the Londoner tried to make himself understood to somebody whose house he went to, she actually thought that he must be speaking French because she couldn't understand what he was saying. He wanted to have eggs. He asked for eggs. The woman didn't know what that meant because the word for eggs in Kent was Aden. And so that's how different the dialects were. So German, Eier, it was more like German in that region. Aden. So this was the way English once was. Standard English became the English that was spoken in the particular region of London, because that's where the juice happened to be, and that rendered Kentish, plus all of these other British dialects that I've been demonstrating in jolly fashion, as something else, as something that I would bring up in this lecture as something exotic. The standard became the one. But that was just a matter of chance. France was the same way. Even today, when you go into the south of France, there are Romance languages spoken, often under these days the cover term Occitan. There used to be a term more often heard, Provençal, which is technically one variety of this group. But these are languages clearly closely related to French. If you see them on the page, you can pick your way through them if you know French. French people can understand them to a very large extent, but they're different enough to be separate languages. And Provençal was one variety. It was the language of the troubadours who pioneered the queer notion of courtly love. It was very much a language back in medieval times. So when France became a nation, rather than this vague region known as Gaul, there was seen to be a problem in that there were all these dialects of French, plus this stuff in the south that was completely different. There was a Catholic priest, his name was Abbé Grégoire, and Abbot Grégoire was worried about this linguistic problem. And often nowadays we think, well, it's a shame if you lose these small languages. And it is. It very much is. But on the other hand, you can imagine the problem with communication if you've decided to forge a nation instead of having a conglomeration of feudal duchies, as was the case before, as in most of Europe. And so, for example, the Abbot Grégoire mentioned in one document in 1789. So we're not talking about the mists of antiquity. This was rather recently. He says, "France is home to perhaps 8 million subjects, of which some can barely mumble a few malformed words or one or two disjointed sentences of our language. The rest know none at all. We know that in Lower Brittany and beyond the Loire, in many places, the clergy is still obliged to preach in the local patois for fear, if they spoke French, of not being understood." And that's talking about France, which, after all, is not all that big, and where now French very much rules the day. That was something that was artificially imposed upon people who, in a not-too-distant day, grew up with different languages, even if they were part of the French polity. And so, the French dialect of the Île-de-France region was imposed for practical reasons. It wasn't that that dialect somehow came off as better or was better in the eyes of God or more coherent or somehow was naturally endowed with a larger vocabulary. It was really just a grand, old, rather ridiculous in its way, accident. And so, every language, when you look at it close up, is a bundle. And often, this process goes in reverse. Something which is standard today becomes just the dialect that you kick around tomorrow, and then sometimes it goes in reverse. So this is exemplified by Ukrainian, the Ukrainian language. And Ukrainian is similar enough today that for a Russian, I think it's safe to say that learning Ukrainian teeters between learning a new language and adjusting to something that's a whole lot like your own. So you can't quite just wrap your ear around it, but on the other hand, learning it is very, very easy. Probably kind of like something a little further out than Scots, but not too much in terms of our English sensibility. And it happened to be that the Ukraine was once cordoned off as a separate region within the Soviet Union. And there was a time when Ukrainian was thought of as just an odd peasant's way of speaking Russian. It used to be, even before the Soviet Union, when we were talking about just Russia, old Russia, you would go to the Ukraine and you would consider yourself to be hearing Russian spoken in a particular and what was thought of as very uncultivated way. People would make fun of Ukrainian. It was thought that Ukrainian was good for jokes and maybe some folk songs, but that this wasn't something that you would write down for any other reason. You certainly wouldn't want to learn it, and the idea of government documents in Ukrainian would have been considered absurd. But then, when you go further back in time, it happens that the center of power in Russia for a period was in Kiev. And at that time, Ukrainian was considered the right kind of Russian. When you're dealing with the archaeology of Russian, you have to deal with this, in a sense, rather peculiar phase from our perspective, in which what we now think of as Ukrainian forms were thought of as a decent model for all of Russia. So it's just a matter of how power went. Then we go through a phase where the power has moved to Moscow and the Ukraine is considered this fertile but backwards and quaint region with this peculiar way of speaking. Now, of course, today, the Ukraine is a country of its own, and even under the Soviet Union, it was an SSR republic. So the language has been standardized, and now, once again, it's considered a language. So Ukrainian goes from being considered the height of Russian and the model for what the language can be, to the speech of peasants, to a language of its own, part of a separate country, the Ukraine. And yet, at all times, the same reality has remained that if you are a Russian speaker, you can go to the Ukraine and you can pick up quite a bit of what's being said, and learning how to speak this way is really no big, big deal. That's always been a fact. How people feel about whether this Ukrainian is a language or a dialect has been based only on who had the geopolitical juice and when. So, the point of this whole lecture has been to show that dialects are what happens when a language changes into various other varieties, and it hasn't done that for long enough a time for there to be separate languages. Instead, what you have are variations on a theme. Those are dialects. And it follows from that, if we're going to understand the rest of the natural history of language, that we have to get rid of a perfectly understandable habit of thinking of the dialect as some sort of bastard, because then we're thinking that there's a whole lot more decay in the natural history of language than there possibly could be. So Brooklyn English and Scots and Standard English are like a Cocker Spaniel and a St. Bernard and a Labrador. There's no such thing as saying that the Cocker Spaniel is the real dog. And you might have a private feeling, like I do, that a Chihuahua is not a real dog. There's something wrong with them. We know that that's a joke, because a Chihuahua and a St. Bernard could mate and produce, you know, a healthy, if rather peculiar, dog. All of them are equal in the eyes of whoever you think are up there. And it's very important to realize, I think this does need to be mentioned, that what I'm saying about all dialects being okay is not politics. There is a tendency for statements like this from linguists to be received as if it's part of the leftist tilt of academia. And the fact is that academia is absolutely shot through with that leftist tilt. It is not a myth, not radicals, but leftists. And often the argument that dialects are okay is made with a political motive, although a benevolent one, in mind, of defending the people who speak non-standard dialects, because the fact is that if you speak natively a variety that doesn't have the juice, chances are that you are disadvantaged in some way, in most situations, particularly in first world countries. So often when dialects are defended, it is with a certain up with people view that may strike people as based more on ideology than on science, whatever the benefits of the argument. But the argument that I'm giving here is designed to help us understand what's coming afterward and to give what is a truth. I personally do not identify as a leftist, and I can honestly say that any linguist who has had basic training, no matter what their politics, would agree with what I've been telling you about how dialects are legitimate. So this is not intended as a statement about this. This is a scientific view of how all languages are bundles of variations. And that's something that we need to understand when we move along to other modules of this series.